Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. President Trump has promised to punish cities that fail to enforce federal immigration laws. He says he'll deny them federal funding. But sanctuary cities, as they're called, see more harm than good in turning over illegal immigrants to federal authorities. This hour, we're going to look at what exactly it means to be a sanctuary city and what that designation might cost cities under a Trump administration. We're also going to talk about the potential outcome for immigrant families and community safety. My guests this hour are Cesar Garcia Hernandez, assistant professor at the University of Denver's Sturm College of Law, and Phil Torrey, supervising attorney for the Harvard Immigration Project. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining me this morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Phil Torrey, to you first. How exactly does a city or county, for that matter, get the designation of being a sanctuary for illegal immigrants?
Well, that's a great question, and I think what's important to understand is the word sanctuary is a bit of a misnomer, and I think it's created a lot of confusion. But because there is no overarching definition, at its base level, I would say that sanctuary policies simply allow local law enforcement to do its job and promote public safety without allowing federal government to come in and commandeer local resources to enforce local immigration laws. So it's a decoupling between local law enforcement and federal immigration enforcement.
Does it have to be a unified front or decision? I mean, do different cities do this, go about this in different ways?
Yes, many cities go about it in different ways, and there's different ways in which cities can determine how they want to promote their own public safety and interact with ICE or not interact with ICE, which is the federal agency responsible for immigration enforcement.
So does that create certain problems in terms of trying to enforce this if people are going about it in different ways, different cities?
Well, sanctuary policies throughout the country do nothing to prevent federal enforcement agents to enforce the federal immigration laws. I mean, they're still allowed to operate within sanctuary cities and sanctuary states. All sanctuary policies do is say that local resources aren't going to be used to hand over immigrants to the federal immigration enforcement agents. So it's a local independent policy determination at a state, county, or city level.
Cesar Garcia Hernandez, why do cities choose to disregard federal law when it comes to reporting illegal immigrants?
Well, city and county elected officials are very attuned to the fact that immigrants are integral parts of their communities. And so sanctuary city policies allow them to send a message to their residents that the city leaders want to foster a welcoming community and the ability to tailor how much they cooperate with ICE or how little they cooperate with ICE is a very traditional method of through which elected officials can convey to immigrants that they believe that these folks are important parts of their community now and in the future.
So the important parts of their community in terms of industry, employment. Talk a little bit more about how they feel that these communities are playing an integral role in the cities.
I think what you see is when you look at cities and counties that have adopted the sanctuary label, that the elected officials there are really looking at the whole fabric of their community. So yes, they're looking at the way in which immigrants contribute to the local economy, but they're also looking at their local schools, and they're seeing that their public schools are filled with the children, the U.S. citizen children, sometimes immigrant children of immigrants themselves. They're looking at their churches and civic community, civic organizations. They're looking at their labor unions. They're looking at neighborhoods and in which the local police department operates, and the way in which immigrants cooperate with local police officers to help keep everyone safe. So I think that the elected officials are not taking a myopic view of immigrants as only contributing to one part of the fabric of life in the United States, but the whole scheme of ways in which we as individuals interact with our neighbors.
And also in terms of, I mean, we're talking about illegal immigrants. Do you think that cities have a sense of, when they're looking at their immigrant communities, about what percentage of them are legal and what percentage are illegal?
Well, I don't think we're only talking about folks who are in the United States without the federal government's permission. Attempts by local elected officials to limit their cooperation with ICE are, in fact, the kinds of tactics that would help folks who are in the United States keep completely off of ICE's radar and not enter into the immigration detention and deportation pipeline. You have to remember that lots of people who are in the United States with the federal government's permission find themselves in immigration court proceedings. Sometimes they win those cases, sometimes they lose those cases. But in every single instance, it's a rather traumatic and difficult experience that I'd venture to say almost all of them would prefer to avoid.
My understanding of the presidential order, and we should talk a little bit about what exactly the presidential order says, is that it's only aimed at those illegal immigrants who have committed a crime. Am I right?
Well, the presidential order prioritizes a fairly large group of folks for potential deportation from the United States. Now, it certainly does include targeting people who are in the United States without the federal government's permission, but it also includes targeting people who are in the United States with the federal government's permission, people who we often refer to as green card holders in immigration laws or permanent residents. That's the kind of individual who has the federal government's permission to make his or make her life in the United States indefinitely. And often they go about doing that in the very, very common ways of sending their children to the public schools and buying property, buying homes and starting businesses. And so they have deep ties to the community. The possibility that they would be taken off and put into the immigration detention deportation pipeline is something that is frightening for them.
We're talking this hour about the sanctuary cities and what exactly might be coming their way based on a presidential order by President Donald Trump saying that they need to enforce federal immigration laws. If you'd like to join the conversation, do you think your city should be a sanctuary city or not? If your city is a sanctuary city, what concerns do you have about what might happen? Give us a call or question with your comment or question. You can reach us at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. And online at nprnews.org/live. Phil Torrey, what else does this executive order say on sanctuary cities?
Well, the executive order specifically targets federal funding for sanctuary cities. Within the order, President Trump has said that or has basically directed immigration enforcement agencies to determine first, you know, what jurisdictions or what localities are considered sanctuary cities, and then it basically threatens to pull federal funding from those locations. I think there's a few different problems with that. First of all, the executive order itself, the way that it's written, is rather confusing, and it's created a lot of chaos and instability in these localities that just aren't sure what is going to happen, how this is going to get enforced. Another problem is that the federal government really doesn't have the ability to completely defund so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. There's a Supreme Court precedent as recent as a couple years ago that has said that the federal government can't use the power of federal funding to unduly coerce or basically force cities to do what it wants in promoting immigration enforcement. So I think those are two sort of problematic pieces of the rather awkwardly and confusingly written executive order.
So is this order constitutional then?
Well, I think it has a lot of constitutional problems, specifically if it's going to target removing all federal funds from cities. There are some federal funds that may potentially be at more risk than others. One thing that's important to keep in mind, and this is sort of resonates with the Supreme Court precedent, is a federal government can't come into a locality and say, for example, we're going to pull all federal funding for school lunch programs unless you help us enforce immigration laws. The courts have said that that's just impermissible. Another thing that the federal government can't do is say, we're going to pull every single federal grant in a particular area unless you help us enforce immigration laws. There's a constitutional structure built in where localities really have the ultimate say in how they're going to police their streets, and the federal government can't come in and coerce a locality to do something different than that.
And yet, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer has said, we're going to strip federal grant money from the sanctuary cities and states that harbor illegal immigrants. So if they were actually able to go ahead with this, how much federal money might these sanctuary cities lose?
Well, it's unclear. The funding that I had mentioned earlier that is potentially more at risk is through the Department of Justice, and that's somewhere around just under $2 billion, I would say. But it's spread across the entire nation. So it's unclear exactly how much money would be at risk. And I would say that if the federal government does in fact decide to defund or pull federal funding from all of these localities, you're going to see a lot of litigation across the country. And this is going to get, it's going to end up in the courts, and it's just going to create even more confusion. So I think that's going to be problematic.
Cesar, President Trump's executive order states many aliens who illegally enter the United States and those who overstay or otherwise violate the terms of their visas present a significant threat to national security and public safety. Is that true?
That sounds to me like an alternative fact, Marianne. We have about a century's worth of data in which clearly indicates that immigrants tend to commit less crime than people who are born in the United States. And so oftentimes immigrant communities are among the safest communities in the United States. We can even look at examples along the Texas border where you have cities with large immigrant populations, and they comprise some of the safest city metropolitan areas in the United States. So I think that kind of language that appears in the executive order is really intended to satisfy President Trump's political base rather than to reflect the reality of immigrant life in the United States.
This hour, we're talking about sanctuary cities and how President Donald Trump has written an executive order to punish sanctuary cities, deny them federal monies if they fail to enforce federal immigration law. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can reach us at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to the phones. We've got Lisa on the line from St. Paul. Lisa, thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you. I was calling to comment that it's very important for the city of St. Paul and Ramsey County to be able to not work together with ICE, because if there are whole communities living in St. Paul that are scared to talk to the police department, then their ability to keep public safety in mind is greatly diminished, and I believe that's why they instituted the policy, because it's critical for communities to cooperate with local law enforcement to police, on our regular local laws. So I think it's a very, very important public safety policy. for the whole community.
Lisa, thanks for your call. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between law enforcement and the immigrant community. And Cesar Hernandez, you're actually the author of a book called Crimmigration, talking about when the law enforcement actually becomes in charge of handling immigration enforcement. Talk about how this changes the relationship between the law enforcement and the community.
Well, I think your caller, Lisa, accurately reflected the view of many law enforcement officers throughout the United States that their principal interest is in keeping the community safe. It's in stopping crime before it happens and investigating and crime that has happened and identifying who those perpetrators. The principal means of ensuring public safety is having good working relationships with the people in that community, having open channels of communication, having relationships built on trust, mutual trust, and so one of the reasons that many law enforcement officers in cities throughout the United States have taken a very skeptical view of cooperating with ICE in helping ICE perform its work of enforcing the federal immigration laws is that immigrants don't see much distinction between the local police officer and the ICE officer if interactions with both mean that they or their loved ones are going to be taken into immigration detention and put into deportation proceedings. So local police quite often take the position, we'd rather focus on our core responsibility of ensuring public safety and leave immigration work up to ICE.
Yeah, Phil Torrey, President Trump's order states, quote, that it seeks to, quote, empower state and local law enforcement agencies across the country to perform the functions of an immigration officer to the maximum extent permitted by law, unquote. Is this something that you see as welcomed by law enforcement, or are there law enforcement agencies out there who are saying, yes, let me add it, this is exactly what I want to be doing, is working on immigration in addition to public safety?
Well, I would just completely echo what Cesar was just saying, in that local law enforcement agencies, their primary goal is public safety. And this is sort of what your caller was getting at. Most law enforcement agencies, in fact, the International Association of Chiefs of Police and also other large local law enforcement agency associations have come out and said that when you combine public safety enforcement and immigration enforcement, you create this chilling effect that Cesar was exactly talking about, and that's really problematic because that can thwart local law enforcement agencies' ability to promote public safety. And when you have folks who are too afraid to come forward and report crimes or help in investigations or serve as a witness in a prosecution, and so. One of the big myths out there is that sanctuary cities somehow allow crime to run rampant, and that's simply not true. It's quite the opposite. There's a recent study that was done that shows that sanctuary cities actually have the crime rates are lower because you have people who are working with the police and they're comfortable in coming forward and talking to the police. And I think that's a structure that any local law enforcement agency would want to see happen.
We have a caller who is called in and wanted just some clarification on something we talked about earlier in the hour. Jack from St. Paul said he wants to clarify. He wasn't quite sure. Does this order actually just target criminals? Because we were talking about how under the order it says that it's referring to illegal immigrants who have committed a crime. But what kind of crimes are we talking about? And is it just limited to those who have committed a crime? Phil Torrey?
Well, there's part of the executive order that does target anybody who's quote-unquote removable. So basically has committed some type of offense that would, under the immigration statute, would mean that they would be deported. And the types of crimes that it, at least on its face, appears to cover is a broad range of offenses. And so there are already very robust systems in place for deporting individuals that have committed very serious offenses. And it's something that the Federal Immigration Enforcement Agency has been spending a lot of resources on. But what this does is it really broadens the scope of individuals who could get swept into the immigration enforcement system by bringing in folks with very, very minor offenses, and offenses that if they were deported for such could have a huge impact on their families and local communities in terms of employment and poverty. And so what it does is it really broadens the scope of who ICE may potentially be looking to sweep into the immigration enforcement system.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Patrick on the line in Minneapolis. Patrick, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Sure thing.
So I believe that as a white guy from greater Minnesota who moved to Minneapolis, that sanctuary cities are keeping me safer in my community. If someone is breaking into my car or my house or anything else, and I have neighbors who are afraid to call the police, that is unsafe for me. I've had situations where I've been the first one on an accident scene, and only after explaining that the ambulance or police won't ask about their immigration status did they allow me to call in so they could get the medical care that they needed. And as someone, as an advocate for survivors of domestic violence, removing, kind of creating the choice, the impossible choice of, do I continue to be abused by my partner or can I call the police without risking the deportation of me and my family? Sanctuary cities are keeping us safer here in Minneapolis.
Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit about how President Donald Trump's status and stance on immigration and the federal enforcement of immigration law and local enforcement of federal of immigration law compares to that of, say, President Obama. Phil Torrey, when looking at Obama's stance on immigration, he deported more than any other president in history. Am I right in terms of illegal immigrants?
That's right. He did deport quite a few individuals and really prioritized the deportation of individuals who were recent entrants across the southwestern border and also folks with criminal convictions.
And so how does his stance, his approach to it, differ from President Trump's?
Well, an important difference, I think, is the priorities, which I mentioned. Basically, what President Obama did was issued an internal memorandum to the immigration enforcement agencies saying, these are the individuals that we're going to focus our resources on. And it was folks that have been convicted of fairly serious offenses, or folks who had recently crossed the southwest border. What President Trump has done in contrast to that was basically throw those priorities out the window, and it's based on the executive order has sort of become a free-for-all. And when you're dealing with an agency that has, you know, a certain amount of resources to enforce those immigration laws, it can be very confusing to know where to sort of prioritize. And so having some kind of priority structure within the agency and a structure that makes good common sense, I think, is important. And that's what appears to have been stripped from that enforcement structure with the recent executive orders.
Cesar Hernandez, let's talk a little bit about the Secure Communities Policy, or SCOM, that President Obama abolished. How did that work?
Well, the Secure Communities Program was an initiative that was really at the core of the Obama administration's immigration enforcement strategy for many years up until they succumbed to political pressure from states and city elected officials that were seeing that many of the folks who were being apprehended through the Secure Communities Program were people who no one would think of as particularly dangerous. These were folks who encountered the criminal justice system because of mundane violations of law, like having a busted taillight and getting pulled over. And then their identification information would get sent over to the Department of Homeland Security
body, and they would be identified as in the country without the federal government's permission as a result. And so no one would deny that these were folks who had been who were violating immigration law, but there were many elected officials who were extremely concerned about the fact that this was actually just instilling fear in immigrant communities, making the work of local police officers more difficult, and at the same time having a hugely adverse impact on families who suddenly lost a parent, children who were traumatized, sometimes ending up in foster care, and obviously on local economies that rely on quite heavily on immigrant workers. And so the Obama administration in November 2014 announced that it would end the Secure Communities Program and replaced it with an initiative called the Priority Enforcement Program, which was more tailored toward people who encountered local police only for more serious offenses, more serious crimes, and only after a conviction. And the executive order signed by President Trump, or one of the executive orders signed by President Trump, recently ends the Priority Enforcement Program and returns to the Secure Communities Program. And so we will see, we'll have to wait and see exactly how it is that they plan to implement this, because one of the major constitutional concerns with the Secure Communities Program that was that ICE regularly issued what are called immigration detainers through the Secure Communities Program. And the immigration detainers are essentially a request by an ICE agent to a local law enforcement agency to continue detaining somebody because ICE thinks that that person might potentially be removable. And courts throughout the United States found that detention with nothing more than a hunch that this person might be in violation of immigration law violates the Fourth Amendment. And if you're violating the Fourth Amendment, then you're on the hook financially for doing so. And local governments, understandably, are not very excited about potentially being financially liable for doing ICE's work.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Juan on the line from St. Paul. Juan, welcome to the conversation.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just have a comment.
Sure.
I, as a legal immigrant, I guess, I deliver the newspaper, and I've been doing it since probably 2002. Every night when I drive around my neighborhood, in the neighborhood that I deliver the newspaper, I have made too many phone calls to the police watching my neighborhood, missing cats, missing dogs, people breaking in garage, people breaking in cars, people drinking on the street, doing drugs, teenagers tagging houses. So many of my customers have always told me, you know, Carlos, you're like the night watch guy for everybody in the neighborhood. And it's very nice that you out there in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, driving around the neighborhood, and you know everybody, you know the neighborhood, and you can like just quick give a call to the police if anything is wrong, if anything seems not to be right. And I don't think I'm gonna keep doing that, you know. And I don't think that's gonna be what's gonna be happening anymore. And it's very sad. It's very sad that it's gonna build like some kind of dividing between me and my neighborhood, me and my neighbors.
Mm-hmm. If St. Paul
just for being afraid, just for being afraid that something bad could happen.
Mm. Juan Carlos, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate it. We're talking this hour about sanctuary cities, the consequences of being a sanctuary city under a Trump administration. You can call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000, or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. And of course, online at nprnews.org/live. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment. But first, it's time for an update of news headlines with Phil Picardi. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Marianne. Experts believe the case may end up before the Supreme Court, but a federal appeals court in San Francisco today hears arguments in the battle over President Trump's travel and refugee ban. The federal government maintains the president has the authority to issue such directives, while states suing Trump, Minnesota and Washington, say his executive order is unconstitutional. House Speaker Paul Ryan says legislation to replace Obamacare will be completed this year. Ryan, a Republican from Wisconsin, says GOP leaders will talk about the plan and get it done and implemented as fast as possible. The Russian military is denying its warplanes have attacked the city of Idlib in northwestern Syria. A defense ministry spokesman says Russian warplanes have not conducted a single strike on the city this year. Syrian opposition activists say a series of airstrikes this morning on the rebel-held city have killed at least 15 people. At least 19 people are dead after a suicide bomb attack at the entrance to Afghanistan's Supreme Court. It's the latest in a series of attacks on the country's judiciary. Meanwhile, Afghanistan's National Security Advisor is appealing to the U.S. to provide aircraft to back ground operations in the country until Afghan security forces can do the job alone. And Twitter is broadening its campaign to clamp down on hate speech and abuse. The company says it's begun identifying people who have been banned for abusive behavior and will stop them from creating new accounts. It is also creating a safe search feature that removes tweets with potentially sensitive content and tweets from blocked and muted accounts from search results. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:37.
Stay tuned. Next on 1A, Trayvon Martin was shot dead 5 years ago this month. The man who shot him was found not guilty. Martin's parents have written a memoir called Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. Host Joshua Johnson talks with them. That's next on 1A.
Programming is supported by the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community, which donates millions of dollars each year to provide scholarships, protect the environment, and improve health and safety in Minnesota communities. Learn more at ShakopeeDakota.org.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, and this hour we're talking about sanctuary cities, how they do not respond to, they do not enforce federal immigration laws, or they choose which laws they're going to enforce, and how President Trump is saying that he's going to punish them for that by stripping them of federal grant funding. We're talking this hour with Cesar Garcia Hernandez, assistant professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law, and Phil Torrey, law lecturer at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we're also taking your calls. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Tom on the line from Montevideo. Tom, welcome to the conversation.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. What's your comment?
Well, I've actually almost kind of changed my comment, but here's my deal. We have a lot of schools in our area that have been closed because there's no money for the schools to stay open. We have a lot of teachers in Minnesota that have lost their jobs because there's no school for our public system. And our infrastructure out in the rural area is very, very poor, bridges, roads, all that kind of stuff. So what some of these people are telling me is they would rather bring in tens of thousands of illegal non-English-speaking immigrants to give them free food, free housing, free medical, free dental, free everything, get them a good job, help them out all they can so we can lay off more teachers. And then one of your guys that was just on said it exactly right. They're afraid of the cops. Well, when they have an accident and they run from the scene of an accident because they can't read, write, or understand the English language, don't worry about the families who are being separated as refugees. What about the family whose mother just got killed from an illegal immigrant or the father who's now crippled? Because an illegal immigrant hit him and can't work anymore.
All right,
Tom. Or lays in the hospital. Why are we so concerned about their rights and not the Minnesota's rights?
Tom, thanks so much for your call. Cesar Hernandez, would you like to respond to this?
Sure. I think it's a point well taken that the local governments are often put in the position of operating schools and other libraries and other institutions that are open to the public and that includes everyone in their communities. And the idea is that schools
public libraries, other institutions of this variety are a means through which we all gather from all walks of life, gather in a common setting, and share various differences. And that's what, one of the things that makes us a single community in the United States, regardless of where we may come from, regardless of what language we may speak at home, regardless of what holidays we may celebrate. But I think one of the your caller's Tom's premise is slightly off insofar as he seems to be under the impression that the economy is a stable, constant entity, that it is, as we often hear it described, actually it is similar to a pie in that it doesn't grow. But on the contrary, the economy is extremely fluid, as we hear every month when we hear news reports about how the GDP is growing or contracting, and inflation is growing and contracting, unemployment, etc. And immigrants, just like anyone else who participates in the labor force, contribute to growing the economy. And so when we're thinking about the cost of that immigrants or any of us, because we all pose a cost to our local government every time we get some benefits or make some demand, we also benefit the local economy.
We're talking about 11 million people here, right? When we're talking about undocumented immigrants in the United States, that's the conservative estimate, is 11 million people.
Yeah, this is obviously a hard population to count, but that is well within the standard description, and so it's a significant population, especially that in many rural parts of the country actually has helped to revitalize communities that have suffered from deindustrialization or other economic shifts. So I think it's important to think about both benefits to the local economy as well as cost, but I think also in terms of being afraid of the police. The fact of the matter is that obviously some people who are immigrants are going to engage in criminal activity. Some people who are immigrants are going to have a car accident that results in the unfortunate death of somebody else. We'd be lying if we pretended that wasn't going to happen. When we're talking about immigrants, we're talking about a population of upwards of 40 million people. So there's a lot of people, and it's a very diverse group of people. But at the end of the day, what we want is for people to be able to cooperate with the police. We can never create a society in which no accidents happen. We can never create a society in which no crime happens and no unfortunate deaths or injuries occur. But we can create a society in which people are willing to work with the legal system to reduce how often those horrible incidents happen, and to make sure that the legal process is able to run its course so that the perpetrators are identified and punished according to whatever the law requires. And fear that's instilled in immigrant communities makes that very, very difficult. And that's exactly why many police officers and police departments shy away from cooperating with ICE's immigration enforcement efforts.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mark on the line from Bemidji. Mark, welcome to the conversation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Yeah, well, my question is a question of a philosophy. So Teddy Roosevelt once said, if you don't like a bad law, you enforce it. You don't ignore it. Because if you ignore it, then what message are you sending, and what is the cost there to society if people can say, I'm going to obey this law, I'm not going to obey that law. I'm a school bus driver. I drive school bus here. There's people, I have flashing red lights that when I open the door, people are supposed to stop. And yet every year there's people that drive through because, no, I don't need to stop. There's no kids. I don't see a kid coming there or there. And sure enough, you know, at what point do we say, who gets to decide which laws we enforce? And this is a federal law. If you don't like the federal law, there's methods, there's ways to change it. But just to say we're not going to follow it, what message and what cost is that going to have to everyone else? Hey, state of Minnesota is going to ignore it. Why can't I ignore state of Minnesota laws, like the school bus lights?
Mm-hmm.
They help you to stop when the kids are crossing, even if I don't see a kid crossing there.
Mark, well, that's a great question. Let's get Phil Torrey to answer it. Phil Torrey, what's your take on this?
Sure.
Yeah, I appreciate that question, and I'm going to try to answer it. I'm not 100% sure that I understand the question, but I think what Mark is talking about is why doesn't Minnesota enforce federal immigration laws in terms of sanctuary policies? And I guess my response would be that sanctuary policies don't or localities that have sanctuary policies are not required to enforce federal immigration laws. In fact, it's quite the opposite, and that's really what's problematic about the executive order. A federal agency cannot the legal notion or the legal term is called commandeering, but the federal agency can't commandeer local resources that have already been determined by a locality within its power, its police powers, to be used towards something else, like public safety. And so there really isn't any sort of federal law that's being broken when a locality creates a sanctuary policy by saying that they're not going to use their local resources to enforce a separate federal immigration law.
Is this a surprising stance for a Republican administration to be really stressing federal reach over independent states' reach?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, traditionally the sort of Republican platform has been state and local autonomy and a weaker, less centralized federal government. And here you sort of have the flip of that. With the recent executive order, you have President Trump, who is basically threatening localities to do something that they have already affirmatively decided is not within their best interests. And the threat is the pulling of the federal money. So I think that's actually a very good point, and it's created this sort of flip in terms of traditionally what a Republican ideal has been.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Veronica on the line from Sioux Falls. Veronica, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I have a question from an economic perspective. Within the last 4 to 5 years, the state of Arizona and several other southern states had actually implemented very strict immigration bans. And within the first year of that Republican-backed immigration ban, the state of Arizona lost over $141 million in just the first few months of implementation and over 3,000 jobs. And they were on course to lose over $2 billion within the first year before the court system undid it. And several other ag states in the South lost billions of dollars in GDP and agricultural income that first year. And I wonder why that's not talked about more, because the immigrant population adds a ton of jobs and a ton of money, way more than what they take out.
Okay. Thanks for that call, Veronica. So, Cesar Garcia Hernandez, you want to talk a little bit about this, about the economic impact of the immigrant population and what sort of an impact we're looking at if we're trying to police them?
Yeah, I think this is an important part of the conversation and one that resonates with your earlier caller, Tom's concern about the economic impact in rural parts of Minnesota in particular. But the reality is that these days immigrants are everywhere. Immigrants aren't limited to the traditional destination states like Arizona or Texas or California. They're in rural parts of Minnesota and other places, which has a long immigrant tradition, but one that for many years in the late 20th century and mid 20th century we forgot about. The reality is that there are now folks doing every kind of job who are immigrants doing it in basically every community in the United States. And so the sheer size of the economic contributions that immigrants make is significant. But I don't think that we ought to understate the impact that immigrants do have on local governments in particular, because most funding for public education in the United States comes from property taxes or other local taxes, and so that tends to, the heaviest burden tends to fall on the local governments to operate the public schools, and so there's sometimes is a mismatch between the impact, the cost that immigrants represent on local governments and the benefit that they represent to the national government. And it's in that mismatch that we can sometimes sort of be talking around each other rather than with each other, where some folks will identify the cost on public schools. And that will be accurate if we're only looking at the cost to the local school district or the local city that or county that funds the bulk of that public school system. And other folks will be talking about the benefit to the national economy, and that's also accurate. And so part of the mismatch is just simply about the way we fund public education in the United States, where very little of it comes from the federal government, and most of it comes from the cities and counties, and to some extent the states. So I don't think we should underestimate the difficulty that some cities and public school officials have in making ends meet. While at the same time, we should also acknowledge the reality that as a whole, immigrants do by and large contribute to the nation's economy and making it the robust, innovative economy that it is.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Nicole on the line from Goodhue. Nicole, welcome. What's your comment or question?
Hi. I just wanted to say that I have a few friends in local law enforcement down here, and while we are far from a sanctuary city, that a lot of the local agencies down here don't necessarily like to rigorously enforce federal immigration law as heavily just because they're not provided federal funding to do so. And it ends up costing them money to hold immigrants for the feds to come get them. So I think that that's something that a lot of more rural communities have.
Okay, Nicole, thanks for that. Phil Torrey, that sounds sort of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, where if you enforce the law, you're putting out money for something that you're not getting reimbursed for from the federal government. And if you don't enforce the law, well, then you're being threatened with having your federal money removed.
Yeah, that's right. And your last caller made a very good point that's important to keep in mind. It sort of wraps into the whole point of the economics of all this, like Cesar was talking about, and the lack of reimbursement. I think in terms of the threat of pulling federal funds, and especially large swaths of federal funds, is something that the federal government really cannot do, and I believe is really unconstitutional. So while the point that localities are on the hook if they're detaining someone solely for immigration law purposes, for not only the resources that are required to do that, whether it's personnel or it's facilities or insurance, but also the liability that may occur. Earlier, Cesar was talking about the Fourth Amendment concerns. If somebody's detained beyond the point where local law enforcement would need to detain them for criminal law purposes, and God forbid something happens to that person, the liability that could come down on the local law enforcement agency could be significant. But this tactic by our current president to basically threaten these localities to enforce federal immigration laws by pulling funding is a coercive means that I think a federal court would find overly or unduly coercive and simply not permit it.
All right. We're going to go back to the phones. We've got to get in a few more callers before the end of the hour here. We've got Sorry, we're not going to go back to the calls just yet. We're hanging on here. Okay, now let's go to Larry from Fargo. Larry, welcome to the conversation. What's your comment or question?
Thank you so much for taking my call. You guys do a great job. I'd like to ask your guest, I'm not opposed to immigration per se and immigrants. We're all immigrants. The problem I have is with illegal immigrants. Why is he so defensive of illegal immigrants? Why can't they enter the country legally?
All right. Larry, that seems like a pretty clear question. Let's take that to Cesar Garcia Hernandez. What do you say?
Well, one of the reasons why folks are not able to enter the United States legally is because there often is no way for them to do so.
The United States immigration system is now sort of categorized into two main paths. One is you can come to the U.S. Because you have certain family relationships. Other is because you have certain employable skills. If you don't fall into one of those buckets, then you don't have there is no line for you to get into.
Well, so maybe we can talk about it. Maybe, Cesar, what would be more helpful is to explain what situations these immigrants are coming from that is compelling them to come to the United States.
Right. Well, a number of the drivers of immigration are the fact that in many countries from which folks are coming from are very difficult for them to make a suitable life for themselves. And so they're seeking exactly the same things that immigrants over the generations, over the centuries of immigration to the U.S. have been looking for, which is a better life for themselves and their children economically. But in recent years, what we've also seen is an uptick in the number of folks who are coming to the United States seeking protection from violence. Sometimes in the past, that was oftentimes civil wars in Central America. These days, it's gang-induced violence and other forms of political instability in Central America as well. And the United States has historically been a refuge for people, a place where people can obtain safety and where we've been willing to incorporate them. And oftentimes, we incorporate them despite what the law says, and quite often, in fact, we know this just from we all know this. We don't have to be experts in immigration to understand that immigrants are able to make a life for themselves in the United States, no matter what the law says. And actually, the fact that we incorporate people into our workforce and allow them to be employed here, despite the fact that the law says they're not even supposed to be here, is actually a way of making sure that labor remains cheap, and that those of us who benefit from that labor are able to do so more inexpensively than would be the case if they had the ability to make a claim for all of the rights that go along with being in the United States lawfully, including rights to organize, meaning having a forceful voice in the workplace about workplace conditions. All of that all of those are things that raise the cost of labor, even though I would say, at least, and I think most of us in the United States would say that those are good, that we ought to have workplace safety laws, that we ought to have minimum age requirements and other things that make our lives as workers more compatible with our lives as humans.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this hour. It's been a very detailed and complicated conversation at points, and I'm imagining that we're going to see several legal battles as this plays out in the coming weeks and months. Thanks so much to both of you for joining me this hour.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We've been talking with Cesar Garcia Hernandez, assistant professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. He joined us from Denver, Colorado. And Phil Torrey, he's a law lecturer at Harvard. He joined us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stay tuned for 1A coming up next at 10 o'clock, and then come back at 11. We're going to be talking about racial inequalities in arts funding. That's coming up at 11 here on Minnesota Public Radio News.